Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are checking in on the royals. We've got some Hollywood news and, of course, plenty of politics. We're going to start off with a kind of an uplifting tribute. On Jackie Robinson Day, I'm remembering the Hall of Famer and my friend Chadwick Boseman, who brought him to life. The writer-director of 42 on the late actor's extraordinary audition and the triumph and heartbreak that followed. This is by Brian Helgeland, published on April 15th. Jackie Robinson Day is upon us, and if current events are any indication, it needs to be celebrated with some exigency this year. As Robinson is rightfully and righteously remembered on ball fields across America, I'd like to remember my friend Chadwick Boseman, who played Jackie in the film 42. I first met Chad in the casting offices of Vicki Thomas. The search for Jack Roosevelt Robinson had begun, and Chad was the second person we met on what promised to be an exhaustive endeavor. He wanted to skip the small talk that generally precedes an audition. I'd like to get right to it, if that's cool. Chad chose to start with the most emotionally challenging of the four scenes he'd been sent. No warm-up, just straight into the fire. As he finished, I knew he'd just cast himself in the film. The exhaustive search had taken 20 minutes, and then he was gone. I said to Vicki, "A movie star just walked out of the room." She knew it too. Chad had been waiting for his chance, and when it came, he owned it. About 2 months later, we stood on the field of UCLA's Jackie Robinson Stadium. We had to pass a bronze statue of the man, so it was pretty clear where we were. By this time, the studio had seen Chad's casting tape, but this is a baseball audition, and 20 people have shown up to watch Chad get worked out. A professional scout for the New York Yankees is here to run the show. Chad is plenty athletic. He played point guard for his high school basketball team, though he hasn't played baseball since Little League. The scout throws Chad a ball, a scout for the New York Yankees, if I didn't make that clear. When Chad throws the ball back, he dirts it. I don't mean it reaches the scout on a hop or two. I mean he rears back and fires the ball into the ground at his own 2 feet. The world stops spinning. Time stands still. Chad looks over at me for a beat and then nods. "I got this, Brian." He picks up the ball and fires it back. Bullseye. Chad nails the workout. He's got the part. We shoot in Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama. I walk into Chad's trailer one day. He freeze frames the movie he's been watching. There's Clint Eastwood on the screen from Coogan's Bluff, of all things. Chad says, "I've been studying him. I love the way he says nothing." Harrison Ford arrives in Chattanooga, in the flesh, not on screen. His first scene is one of his most emotional in the movie. It's when he finally answers Jackie's thrice-asked question, "Why are you doing this, Mr. Ricky?" Chad simply needs to listen to his confession. But he not only holds his ground opposite Ford, he maybe even steals the scene, just listening. Back behind those monitors, I think, I love the way Chad says nothing. When we're done, Ford asks me, "Is that what he's been doing?" It's not a criticism. Ford is impressed. On a sweltering day in Macon, Rachel Robinson makes an appearance. Legendary entertainment CEO Thomas Tull, who embraced Chad as Jackie early on, has scooped her up in his jet and deposited her by the visitor's dugout. Possessed of royal bearing that QE2 could only dream of, Mrs. Robinson meets the actors playing the Dodgers, and they announce who they are portraying. She's delighted to meet the ones who treated her husband fairly, but keeps the ones who didn't at arm's length. Chad has met her several times, but this is the first time she has seen him in uniform as her husband. As Chad moves to hug her, she puts an arm to block him. "Get away from me with all that sweat," she laughs. He smiles the most beautiful smile. "Come here," he says, and then takes her into his arms. Mrs. Robinson melts. For a moment, she is with her beloved Jack again. Finally, we shoot a day in Brooklyn, in and around the actual brownstone apartment Jackie and Rachel lived in 1947. Chad arrives on the set in costume, and he is nearly speechless. It turns out we're shooting on the same street that he himself lived on before he moved to Los Angeles. He lived on Jackie Robinson Street without knowing it. On his way to the set, old neighbors stop him. "We haven't seen you in a while. What are you up to?" "Well, I just came back to play Jackie Robinson." On that day, I started to believe in fate. Coincidences are just not that coincidental. We are on an ADR stage recording a few lines of dialogue during post-production. The ADR recordist keeps stopping the take. He's picking up some metallic sound on his headphones. Finally, he asks if anyone has any loose change in their pockets. Chad sheepishly pulls out $10 in quarters out of his jeans. As he sets them on the table, he explains to me, "I gotta go do my laundry after this." In response, the recordist's voice over a speaker, "After this movie comes out, you're never gonna have to do your own laundry again." Chad gives me a wistful look and whispers, "I like doing my own laundry." They're screening the film at Dodger Stadium after a game on the huge video screens in the outfield. 10,000 people end up staying to watch. The Dodgers have asked Chad to throw out the game's opening pitch. He calls me a week out. "I can't do it, man. I can't go out there and throw the first pitch into the ground. You gotta do it." I measure out 60 feet 6 inches in my backyard and practice. This is going to be a disaster, but better me than Chad. 10 minutes before my public humiliation, Chad comes over and says, "I got this." It's like the governor signed a stay of execution. Chad goes to the mound and throws a perfect strike. After 42 was long gone from the theaters, we used to go to Sky Tacos on Pico to catch up and trade schemes we had for the future. Chad was on a crazy ride, an overnight sensation if you ignore the decade of yeoman anonymous work that came before it. But if anyone could take a roller coaster ride in stride, it was Chad. We would shoot the breeze for an hour or two every few months at this spot. On one particular day, we took our tacos outside to a sidewalk table. After a minute, Chad suddenly asked if I minded switching places. We do-si-do'd. I sat the other way, wondering what was bothering Chad about this seat. And then I saw it. A block down Pico, an enormous rooftop billboard with Chad, 25 feet tall, leaning over a microphone as the godfather of soul, James Brown. I think he knew his days of sitting at Sky Tacos, being known simply for how friendly he was, were over. It was also at Sky that Chad told me he was in love. It was the real thing, and it was far and away finer than any billboard. In 2016, I got a call from that love, Simone Ledward, asking me if I could come to the hospital. A volatile health episode had landed Chad there. The details are private, but he was faced with life-changing news. An enormous future was opening up before him. But was it? We talked about his hospital socks, the color he was wearing. An easy-to-spot reference for the staff was a dire indicator of his current condition. We talked about how he needed to get out of those socks and into a less serious pallet. A few days later, he was in different colored socks. A clock was ticking, but the fight had begun. We would always discuss his illness obliquely. Chad, in fact, would never give cancer its name. We only ever talked about it in terms of socks. "What color socks do you got on today?" "I'm doing everything I can to keep those socks off my feet." His battle would be his own, shared only with those closest to him. In 2020, because of the pandemic, Jackie Robinson Day, traditionally held on April 15th, was delayed until August 28th. Chad died that day with his family by his side. On Jackie Robinson Day. Put that in your coincidence pipe and smoke it, y'all. His memorial was held on a beautiful day on a bluff in Malibu overlooking the sea. His casket rested under a canopy, and one after the next, people stepped up to say their farewells. I watched from afar. Something was holding me back. I still can't quite explain it, but I think I was afraid, just plain old afraid. Finally, I went down and stepped up before him. They say rest in peace. If anyone needed a rest, it was Chad. He's accomplished so much after 42 in such a little time. All the films he's made, from Black Panther to Ma Rainey's, were filmed during and between countless surgeries and treatments. I had something I wanted to say to him, except there on top of his casket was a wooden cross, and printed on it was the number 42. Beyond the film, it was a hugely important number to him, a mile marker, a part of him that he carried. It gave him strength somehow. Right then, it took all mine away. A year or so after Chad passed, I had my own stare down with cancer. I promised Chad I would fight like he fought. I didn't have to. Mine was spotted early, a kindergarten version compared to his. Life is unfair, even when it comes to cancer. Cancer took Chad away, but in no way did it beat him. The king still wears the crown, the belt, and the mantle. Unequivocally, cancer did not beat him. The number 42 has been retired by every team across baseball in honor of Jackie Robinson. His legacy, of course, is unbeaten and still fighting, despite the Department of Defense taking down a webpage honoring his military service earlier this year. The number 42 is also retired in my heart, where Chadwick Boseman will always be loved and will always be with me. We're going to stay in the Hollywood celebrity category. Our next headline, Life is a Cabaret. Liza Minnelli makes a rare public appearance for RuPaul's Drag Race finale. The 79-year-old icon received the show's third annual Giving Us Lifetime Achievement Award before the season 17 winner was crowned. This is by Eve Beatty on April 19th. The true star of Friday's season 17 finale of RuPaul's Drag Race wasn't its winning queen or its host, RuPaul Charles. Instead, it was Liza Minnelli who stole the show, taking a seat in a massive onstage throne for a pre-crowning bit of banter with RuPaul. Minnelli, the 79-year-old stage and screen icon and daughter of Julie Garland and director Vincente Minnelli, was awarded the show's third ever Giving Us Lifetime Achievement Award. Previous recipients included Cassandra Peterson, better known perhaps as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and designer Bob Mackie. Revealed to the crowd as her 1972 version of Ring Them Bells played, a Houston-clad Minnelli reclined on her throne as the audience stood, clapped, and chanted, "Liza." "Look at you," she said to RuPaul, admiring the host's tulle-laden look. "I know, it only took 6 hours," replied the 64-year-old RuPaul. "Seven for me," Ms. Liza Minnelli shot back. "I'm older than you." RuPaul, a noted appreciator of old Hollywood lore, asked Minnelli about her childhood on the MGM lot. "Everybody would rush to see whatever my mother was doing, and my father especially, because he was making people do magic," Minnelli said. "Oh, he was the best." The Drag Race host also asked about a 1980s-era newspaper photo of Minnelli holding a guitar to go record with the Pet Shop Boys. "Why were you holding a guitar?" "Because they told me to hold it," Minnelli responded. "What would you do?" she asked the chuckling crowd. "I'm a director's daughter." Speaking with Variety, Drag Race producer Tom Campbell said that Minnelli's appearance on the finale came straight from Rue herself. "She seemed ungettable, like that's too much to ask for," Campbell said, but the competition show lucked out. Her management were also big fans of Drag Race, and they know what we've done, and they know the heart of the show, and they're invested as viewers. Friday's appearance was one of Minnelli's highest-profile appearances since 2022, when she appeared at the Oscars for an onstage bit with Lady Gaga, an appearance that longtime friend and collaborator Michael Feinstein characterized as sabotage. She only agreed to appear on the Oscars if she would be in the director's chair, because she's been having back trouble, Feinstein said then. She said, "I don't want people to see me limping out there." She said, "You know, I want to look good. I don't want people to worry about me." But minutes before her appearance, Feinstein said she was told she'd have to enter in a wheelchair instead. "She was nervous, and it made her look like she was out of it," said Feinstein. "Can you imagine being suddenly forced to be seen by millions of people the way you don't want to be seen? That's what happened to her." By contrast, the Minnelli that I saw Friday night seemed sharp as a tack and also appeared delighted to appear on stage with RuPaul. "I don't know what else to say, except if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be me. You made me," Minnelli said to the room at large. "Well, you made us, actually," RuPaul responded before moving on to the final lip-sync battles of the evening between the final four queens, Lexi Love, Anya Nerve, Jules Sparkles, and Sam Starr. And while Cleveland-based Nerve emerged the victor, it's likely that many of us will remember the finale as Liza's night instead. Our next headline, Tina Fey, hater of celebrity side hustles, says her impulse to hide and retire is very strong. Fey has no plans to secure a non-showbiz stream of income or overstay her Hollywood welcome. "I am so tired of hearing from me." This is by Savannah Walsh on April 17th. Tina Fey, who once declared that authenticity is dangerous and expensive when you're in the public eye, nevertheless got candid about her plans to retreat from the spotlight in a Hollywood Reporter interview published Wednesday. The impulse to hide and retire is very strong because I do think it's time to help new voices get in the mix, the 54-year-old said. It's something I'm already doing, but I want to do more. Even on the walk over here, I was like, I'm so tired of hearing from me. Surely everyone else is tired of hearing from the same people over and over again. Throughout the course of her career, Fey has helped create a slew of films and TV shows, including Mean Girls, 30 Rock, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and the upcoming Netflix series, The Four Seasons, debuting on May 1st. Now Fey straddles the line between championing fresher talent and being tapped to succeed a comedy giant. Case in point, in the interview, Fey dismissed the idea that she'd return to host the Golden Globes, instead praising the award show's newest MC, who will take on the role for the second year in a row. Nikki Glaser killed it at the Globes, and she should keep that job forever. But when asked about Saturday Night Live creator and producer Lorne Michaels' comment that Fey, a former head writer for the NBC sketch series, could easily take over for him, she replied, "It was nice of him to say that, and I love him very much, but he's irreplaceable," adding, "His set of gifts and skills are entirely unique. His eye for talent. He's one of the last three people in show business who actually understand everything. I'll leave it at that." Recently, Fey has proven to be a voice of reason, notably publicizing her problem with rich people having side hustles during an appearance on friend Amy Poehler's podcast. Fey said that all she needed was to feel safe and to have enough money to live, explaining her objection to securing another source of income, like, say, a hair care or eyewear line outside of showbiz. And when the time comes to step out of the spotlight, Fey will be happy to do so. "People who know me have said, 'You wouldn't be able to retire. You'd be so unhappy,'" she told The Hollywood Reporter. "Wrong. I'd still be busy all the time. It would just be with dumb stuff." Let's check in on the royals. King Charles is focused on faith, hope, and love this Easter. The king was joined by Queen Camilla at Durham Cathedral for the annual Maundy Thursday ceremony, honoring community elders with special coin purses. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on April 17th. After King Charles III's cancer diagnosis in 2024, Queen Camilla made royal history as the first consort to participate in the Maundy Thursday ritual of passing out coin purses to community elders. Though the king's treatment is still ongoing, this year he and the queen traveled together to Durham Cathedral to hand out the annual Royal Maundy money to 76 men and women, a number chosen to reflect the king's age. This year's gift also included a special 5-euro coin commemorating the Queen Mother with a message about World War II. The ceremony, which takes place during Holy Week in the run-up to Easter Sunday, honors recipients for outstanding Christian service in a different Church of England cathedral every year. On Thursday morning, the King also released his annual Easter message, where he praised humanitarians who respond to the atrocities of war. "There are three virtues that the world still needs: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love," he wrote. "It is with these timeless truths in my mind and my heart that I wish you all a blessed and peaceful Easter." The statement also mentioned the personal significance of the day's event, emphasizing the connections between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. "On Maundy Thursday, Jesus knelt and washed the feet of many of those who would abandon him. His humble action was a token of his love that knew no bounds or boundaries and is central to Christian belief," the king continued. "The love he showed when he walked the earth reflected the Jewish ethic of caring for the stranger and those in need, a deep human instinct echoed in Islam and other religious traditions, and in the hearts of all who seek the good of others." The special outing comes just 1 week after the king, who also serves as the head of the Church of England, and queen met with Pope Francis during their royal tour to Italy. According to the palace, Charles and Camilla were delighted to see the pope, who was recovering from a lengthy hospital stay for double pneumonia, and to have had the opportunity to share their best wishes in person. Next in the Royals, the love story of the royal family and Cartier, told through one spectacular pink diamond. A curator of the Victoria and Albert Museum's Cartier exhibition explains how the jeweler's elegance and discretion led to the Williamson brooch, one of Queen Elizabeth's most beloved gems. In May of last year, Queen Camilla and King Charles III made an appearance at Buckingham Palace garden party, one of their first since the king announced his cancer diagnosis 3 months earlier. Perhaps to mark the emotional significance of the moment, the queen wore the Williamson brooch, a truly spectacular 23.6-carat pink diamond set in platinum, designed by Cartier in 1953. The brooch, which matched Camilla's pink Anna Valentine coat dress and the king's pink cummerbund, was designed for Queen Elizabeth early in her reign, and the late queen brought it out for sentimental moments throughout her life. When Queen Camilla wore the brooch last May, she was continuing to breathe new life into the legendary royal collection. At the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, where a much-anticipated Cartier exhibition opens on April 12th, co-curators Helen Molesworth and Richard Garahan worried they might not be able to include it in the upcoming show. "We are very fortunate that the king is lending it to us for the show," Garahan tells Vanity Fair. "It is only by seeing it in real life that visitors can really make that connection between the piece and the drawings and the people who made it." The brooch features 170 small brilliants, 12 baguettes, and 12 marquees alongside its pink centerpiece set in a platinum truss designed to showcase the diamonds and practically disappear. It will be on public display at the museum's South Kensington location until November 16th as a part of a survey of the house's nearly 180-year history, featuring objects from the early days of its popularity among the British aristocracy, like the Manchester tiara and fern brooches, both from 1903, all the way to a whimsical 2024 carabiner watch. In assembling the exhibition, Molesworth and Garahan were able to dive into the company's archives, along with related materials from the royal archives. All the royal pieces, through five generations, show how times change and tastes change. Garahan says, "Cartier is able to offer something that has relationship with the royal family in order to adapt to that." The British royals are devoted to Cartier, and vice versa. King Edward VII first gave the brand a royal warrant, a public certification for companies who provide goods or services to the royal household, in 1904, and Windsors ranging from Queen Mary to Wallace Simpson to Queen Mother to Princess Diana to Meghan Markle have all incorporated pieces from the company into their collections. Cartier still holds a royal warrant to this day, and Garahan says that the show illustrates why the bond remains so strong. Trust is absolutely essential in any client-jeweler relationship, but if you're a royal family, then trust is on a whole nother level, she adds. Discretion, elegance, all these things would have been and still are important to important clients, and Cartier was able to manage these well. The Queen's beloved Williamson brooch was named for John Williamson, the Canadian mine owner who provided the pink diamond as a wedding present when Elizabeth married Prince Philip in 1947. Using notes and sketchbooks from the archives, Garahan found that the stone was incorporated into the brooch as the result of a close collaboration between the Queen and the company's designer, Frederick Mew. Four gouache paintings that Mew created for the Queen's approval are on display in the show next to the finished brooch. Garahan also learned that Williamson had originally hoped to present the Queen with more pink diamonds to fill out the brooch. It seems Williamson was unable to find any more in his mine, so he provided more than 200 white diamonds instead. Mew, who worked at Cartier from the late 1920s until his retirement in 1971, was a great lover of nature, like the late queen. Garahan pointed to design illustrations for delicate kingfisher brooches, also included in the exhibition, as evidence of his innovative approach to incorporating the shapes of nature into figurative jewelry. "He was a very humble but talented artist," she says. "In the Williamson designs, you see different varieties of flower and the way you use diamond cuts to bring out different elements of a design." The Queen's diamond has never changed hands, but in 2022, a smaller pink diamond from the Williamson mine set records when it was auctioned for $57.7 million, or about $5.2 million a carat. The Cartier archives themselves don't shed much light on what motivated Williamson, a Quebec-born geologist without any obvious ties to the Windsors, to give the Queen such a lavish gift. Writing in 1969, jewelry historian Sheila Young described the mine owner as having a passionate personal attachment to the royal family. Tanganyika, now known as Tanzania, was part of the British Empire when Williamson discovered a diamondiferous area in its borders. Though there is some dispute about whether locals were aware of the mine before Williams set up his operation, his interest in it made him an extremely wealthy man. On the future queen's wedding day in November 1947, the uncut diamond was on display at St. James Palace alongside other gifts given by Canadians, including an emerald and diamond necklace from the people of Victoria, British Columbia. Trade journal Gems and Gemology would report in its winter 1948 issue that the diamond trading company tasked diamond cutters Briefel and Lemer to turn the 54 raw carat diamond into a brilliant cut stone. In March 1948, Elizabeth, then Princess of York, was joined by her grandmother, Queen Mary, at the firm's Clerkenwell Green factory, where they inspected the diamond and saw the process in action. It was incorporated into Mew's design, and the finished product became one of Elizabeth's most sentimental pieces. She wore it to three major royal weddings: the marriage of the Duke and Duchess of Kent in 1961, the televised nuptials of Charles and Princess Diana in 1981, and the marriage of Prince Edward and Sophie, Duchess of Edinburgh, in 1999. The Queen likely never met Williamson before his death in January 1958, and her personal feelings about the man and his gift will probably remain unclear until more of her personal papers are made public. One of the best clues as to Williamson's motivation might come from a fascinating account of what it was like to visit the shy and mysterious tycoon at his mine, often called Mwadwi, outside of Shinyaga, in an article for Maclean's magazine called My Strange Encounter with the Diamond King. Canadian businessman Robert Kipp told the story of his 1951 travels to Tanganyika to show Williamson and his polishing machines in action. In his essay, Kipp explained that his time at the mine exposed him to a sheer glut of raw diamonds, to the point that Kipp became bored with them. The grubby, glass-like lumps were as commonplace as potatoes, he continued. Like everyone else at Mwadi, I literally walked on them. They are mined only a few inches from the surface. I saw rough diamonds packed in flat tins and tucked into shirt pockets as casually as cigarettes. I saw them in glass jars, tier upon tier, in Williamson's safes. And sometimes I found myself alone in a sorting room, trickling a fortune in stones through my fingers. In 1976, Williamson's biographer, John Gowan, described the gift to Queen Elizabeth as an example of the miner's attention to the personal obligations which he felt were his duty. It's easier to give nearly 200 diamonds to a hereditary monarch when you have plenty to spare. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently reading from vanityfair.com, and it's time to transfer over to the politics section. Our first headline, J.D. Vance drops the ball, a trophy, at the White House. Will his approval rating take a hit? According to a recent poll, 49% of Americans have an unfavorable view of the vice president, while 52% have an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. This is by Armietta Diop on April 15th. Vice President J.D. Vance dropped the college football playoff national championship trophy at the White House on Monday during a ceremony on the South Lawn. The Ohio State Buckeyes, Vance's alma mater, were invited by Donald Trump to celebrate the team's title-winning season, only to encounter this fumble. The Buckeyes defeated Notre Dame for the trophy, which is made of a 12-inch bronze base and a separate 26.5-inch trophy made from 24-karat gold, bronze, and stainless steel. Together, the pieces weigh 50 pounds, which does explain why Trayvon Henderson, a running back on the team, tried to help when Vance originally went to hoist it from the table and the two components separated with the base toppling to the ground. Eventually ditching the base altogether and holding the trophy for the group photos, Vance later joked on X, quote, "I didn't want anyone after Ohio State to get the trophy, so I decided to break it." A sentiment that appears to be the administration's undercurrent, breaking norms, Democratic, legal, and otherwise, as Trump and Vance near their first 100 days in office, a benchmark that has traditionally been used to measure presidential performance. According to a recent Reuters ISPOS survey conducted March 31st to April 2nd, 49% of Americans have an unfavorable view of the vice president, while 41% view him favorably. Meanwhile, 52% of Americans have an unfavorable view of Donald Trump, while 45% view him favorably. But the divide falls starkly among party lines, as 83% of Republicans say they view Vance favorably, and 88% of Republicans say they view Trump favorably. It's unclear if Vance's ill-timed drop will affect his approval rating, but the president is touting the deepening embrace of MAGA throughout the Republican Party. According to a new NBC News poll, 36% of registered voters identify as MAGA supporters, with 71% of Republicans calling themselves MAGA supporters. Hours after Vance's mishap, Trump took to Truth Social to spread the MAGA gospel. A just-out NBC poll says that MAGA is gaining tremendous support. I am not at all surprised. And in Easter greetings, Pope Francis meets J.D. Vance on Easter Sunday for a brief conversation after a clash over immigration. A Catholic convert, the vice president spent the weekend in Rome meeting with various Italian and Vatican leaders. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on April 20th. Vice President J.D. Vance sat down with Pope Francis on Sunday morning and exchanged Easter greetings in a previously unannounced meeting following the pair's long-distance clash over President Donald Trump and his administration's handling of immigrant deportation plans. According to Politico, Vance's motorcade entered Vatican City through a side gate and parked near Francis's hotel residence while Mass was being celebrated in St. Peter's Square. The Pope, who has greatly cut back his workload to recover from a near-fatal case of double pneumonia in February, met with the vice president for a few minutes at the Domus Santa Marta. Vance, who was baptized as a Catholic 6 years ago, has been in Rome for the weekend to celebrate the holiday and visit with Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni and leaders within the Vatican. His wife, Usha Vance, is there as well. The Sunday meeting, which the Vatican called brief, comes after the Pope called the U.S.'s immigration crackdown a disgrace and criticized the policies of Trump's administration, including deep cuts to foreign aid and social services. Days before being hospitalized in February, Francis penned an open letter to American bishops urging them to reject anti-immigrant narratives, the decisive rebuke from the Pope. "Deporting migrants who often come from difficult situations," Francis wrote, "violates the dignity of many men and women and of entire families." The pontiff said he has followed closely the major crisis that's taking place in the United States and the initiation of a program of mass deportations, and believes that any policy built on force begins badly and will end badly. In his letter, the Pope specifically referenced Vance's use of Catholic doctrine to justify the administration's treatment of immigrants. In late January, the vice president invoked the concept of Ordo Amoris, a Christian motto that refers to how believers prioritize giving love and charity to others when talking about immigration. He said that Americans ought to focus on family, neighbor, community, and your fellow citizens in your own country before you can focus on and prioritize the rest of the world. The Pope didn't like that interpretation, writing, "Christian love is not a concentric expansion of interests that little by little extend to other persons and groups. The true Ordo Amoris that must be promoted," he continued, "is love that builds a fraternity open to all, without exception." Vance later acknowledged Francis's criticism during a late February appearance at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast in Washington. Vance didn't address the issue specifically and has said he will continue to defend his views, but called himself a baby Catholic with things about faith that I don't know. While Pope Francis has critiqued Trump and his administration in the past, even suggesting in 2016 that he was not Christian for his hopes for the border wall, the Supreme Pontiff didn't go as far as endorsing a candidate in 2024. In September of last year, he criticized both Trump and then-Vice President Kamala Harris for being too anti-immigration and pro-abortion, respectively. He told reporters, "One must choose the lesser of two evils. Who is the lesser of two evils, that lady or that gentleman? I don't know." Prior to exchanging Easter greetings with the Pope on Saturday, the Vances received a private tour of the Sistine Chapel before the Vice President met with the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, and the Foreign Minister, Archbishop Paul Gallagher. While the Holy See reaffirmed the good relationship with Vance, he also noted an exchange of opinions on current international conflicts, migration, and prisoners. There was an exchange of opinions on the international situation, especially regarding countries affected by war, political tensions, and difficult humanitarian situations, with particular attention to migrants, refugees, and prisoners, a statement from the Vatican said. Finally, hope was expressed for serene collaboration between the state and the Catholic Church in the United States, whose valuable service to the most vulnerable people was acknowledged. The Vice President's office confirmed the meeting between Vance and Parolin, but didn't mention any differing opinions, saying they discussed their shared religious belief, the religious faith, Catholicism in the United States, the plight of persecuted Christian communities around the world, and President Trump's commitment to restoring world peace. Before Vance's visit, Cardinal Parolin told the Italian newspaper La Repubblica that it is clear that the approach of the current U.S. administration is very different from what we are used to. And, he noted, different, especially in the West, from what we have relied on for many years. Next up, constitutional crisis. The Supreme Court blocks Trump admin's use of wartime law to deport Venezuelan migrants, at least for now. The latest showdown between the executive and judicial branches deepens constitutional crisis concerns. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on April 19th. The U.S. Supreme Court temporarily barred President Donald Trump's administration from deporting Venezuelan men in immigration custody early Saturday morning after the lawyers feared their clients were at imminent risk of being sent out of the country. The government is directed not to remove any member of the putative class of detainees from the United States until further order of this court, the justice said in a brief unsigned decision. Conservative justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito dissented in a ruling that was issued just after midnight. Lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union filed an urgent request on Friday with the Supreme Court and multiple other courts after receiving reports that some of the men had already been loaded onto buses and were being told they were going to be deported, possibly to the notorious prison in El Salvador, where others have been jailed. But the ACLU argued that these men had not been given due process by the Trump administration, as required by the Supreme Court. According to the defense team, the men had received a notice saying that they had been classified as members of the Tren de Aragua, a criminal gang originating from Venezuelan prisons that Trump and his administration has labeled a terrorist group, and that they have been determined to be an alien enemy subject to apprehension, restraint, and removal. Trump previously invoked the Alien Enemies Act, a centuries-old wartime authority that grants the president the ability to detain or deport the natives and citizens of another nation, to remove men that immigration enforcement claimed were members of the Tren de Aragua. These men were in imminent danger of spending their lives in a horrific foreign prison without ever having had a chance to go to court. We are relieved that the Supreme Court has not permitted the administration to whisk them away the way others were just last month, Lee Gallant, the ACLU's lead attorney in the case, said in a statement on Saturday. As of Saturday morning, the White House has not immediately responded to a request from Reuters for comment. When President Trump was asked on Friday about the planned deportations of the Venezuelan men, he claimed he was unfamiliar with the particular case, but said that if they're bad people, he would certainly authorize it. The Trump administration, including the president, Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, and other immigration officials have, in the few months since taking office, rolled out a coordinated onslaught against immigrants, both documented and not, across the country. This comes after Trump, when running for office, referred to immigrants as animals and said that they are poisoning the blood of our country. In March, more than 130 men, whom the Trump administration claimed were Tren de Aragua members, were deported to El Salvador. Family members and lawyers for the men said that they were signaled out because of tattoos that they have, but an expert on the gang told NBC that tattoos are not closely connected with affiliation to Tren de Aragua, that the Venezuelan gangs are not identified by tattoos. Immigration officials have maintained that they did not solely rely on tattoos to identify the deportees as alleged gang members. In early April, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration's use of the 1798 law, with certain limits. The justices, in a 5-4 decision, said that detainees must receive notice that they are subject to removal and be given enough time to seek what due process is granted to them. The latter requirement is what the ACLU is claiming the Trump administration failed to do. It's unclear if the president and those in control of immigration enforcement within his administration will follow the Supreme Court ruling. The administration has so far failed to comply with another directive from the court to facilitate the return of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran immigrant living in Maryland who was illegally deported to El Salvador's high-security mega-prison known as the Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT. The case of Abrego Garcia, who is married to a U.S. citizen, has resulted in an ongoing legal battle involving the Trump administration, local and national courts, Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, and the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele. As of Saturday, Abrego Garcia was reportedly moved from CECOT to a detention center hours away. It's still unclear if or when he will be returned to his family in Maryland, despite the Supreme Court's directive. Next up, how a no-scalps policy is shaping Trump's consequence-free second term. The more the media reports on the president's norm-busting and law-flouting, the more he digs in. It's already created an administration essentially immune to traditional accountability journalism. This is by Gabriel Sherman on April 16th. Since the nation's founding, the national press has played a vital role in the system of checks and balances that undergirds American democracy. John F. Kennedy famously extolled the importance of journalism as a corrective to bad policymaking after he authorized the disastrous CIA mission to invade Cuba in 1961. Maybe if you had printed more about the operation, you would have saved us from a colossal mistake, Kennedy later told the New York Times managing editor Turner Catledge. Then came the Donald Trump era. Call it Trump's law of political anti-gravity. In his second term, negative news reports are motivating Trump to double down rather than moderate. This dynamic has its most prominent display yet when Trump hosted El Salvador's strongman president, Nayib Bukele, in the Oval Office on Monday. For weeks, the media has reported on the case of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man whom the administration admitted to having mistakenly deported to El Salvador's notorious Terrorism Confinement Center. The Supreme Court ruled last week that the administration needed to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return to the United States. Trump, with Bukele at his side, mocked a CNN reporter who asked if he was planning to comply with that order. Microphones later captured Trump telling Bukele he needed to build 5 more prisons so that El Salvador could lock up American citizens convicted of violent crimes. Trump seems to be using Abrego Garcia's case to send a bigger message. The mainstream media will never influence what he does. Whether the courts can compel him is another, perhaps even darker question. Or rather, the intensity of reporting on Trump's breaking of a rule or norm dictates his instinct to continue doing so. This strategy is part of the MAGA movement's authoritarian project to delegitimize the media, a fact those in its sway are not particularly shy about. No one cares what the New York Times says, or any of you guys. None of this bullshit and none of the lies are going to make a difference, a prominent Republican close to the White House told me. One of the principal goals of Trump's second term is to correct what the president views as the mistakes of his first. Trump has reportedly told people that one of his first term regrets was forcing his first national security advisor, Michael Flynn, to resign after it was revealed that Flynn had lied about conversations with Russia's ambassador to the United States. This may help to explain why Trump stood by Pete Hegseth, his embattled defense secretary, even after reports detailed episodes of alleged excessive drinking and that he had paid a $50,000 settlement to a woman who had accused him of sexual assault. Hegseth has denied the allegations. Trump's ignore the media strategy also influenced his decision to publicly support his current national security advisor, Michael Waltz, after Waltz mistakenly added Atlantic editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg to a signal group in which administration officials were texting about military strikes in Yemen. Another Republican close to the White House told me Waltz was saved because Trump has a post-Flynn, quote, no scalps policy, as the source described it. The dynamic has proven remarkable for even seasoned presidential reporters. This is a president who doesn't believe in admitting mistakes, period. And that trickles down to the people who work for him, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker told me this week. So when a news outlet points out something that went wrong or corrects inaccurate statements, the default setting is not to fix the error, as other presidents might do, but to double down. Taking action in response to a news report would be seen as an admission of weakness, and nothing is a bigger cardinal sin in Trump's mind. It amounts to a toxic cycle of escalation that doesn't show much sign of abating anytime soon. Authoritarian regimes often fail because their leaders refuse to course correct when presented with outside information. In an interview more than a year after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, Kennedy lauded the role journalism could play in preventing future crises. It is never pleasant to be reading things that are not agreeable news, but I would say that it is an invaluable arm of the presidency as a check, really, on what's going on in the administration, he said. Our next headline, Obama praises Harvard for standing up to Trump and calls on other universities to do the same. The president, meanwhile, escalated the clash, threatening Harvard's tax status. This is by Eric Lutz on April 15th. In short order, Donald Trump has managed to bend to his will much of the American political system and many major institutions outside government, like law firms and universities. But Harvard University, in refusing his demands Monday, is setting an example for other Trump targets to follow. Let's hope other institutions follow suit, as former President Barack Obama wrote Monday evening, praising the Ivy League school for rejecting an unlawful and ham-handed attempt to stifle academic freedom. Obama had been pushing for higher education institutions to avoid being intimidated by Trump's bullying, as Columbia University and some top law firms like Paul Weiss have been as the administration threatens their funding and operations. We're in one of those moments when it's not enough just to say you're for something, the former president said earlier this month in an appearance at Hamilton College. You may actually have to do something and possibly sacrifice a little bit. And indeed, it seems Harvard will have to sacrifice for its stand. After Harvard released a letter Monday saying it was not prepared to agree to demands that go beyond the lawful authority of this or any administration, the administration said it would freeze more than $2 billion in federal funding as punishment. Then, on Tuesday, the president on Truth Social escalated the clash between the elite university and the White House, threatening Harvard's tax status. The Trump administration has been pressuring universities under the guise of combating anti-Semitism on campuses, but the administration's stated intent to root out anti-Semitism is but a cynical cover for its more earnest ambitions to dismantle diversity initiatives and to cow institutions seen as bastions of liberalism. The universities all seem so powerful, and they have acted as if they're all powerful, and we're finally revealing that we can hit that where it hurts, conservative activist Christopher Rufo told the New York Times Monday. We want to set them back a generation or two. The administration's hardball unquestionably puts universities and other institutions in a difficult position. Harvard's letter, written by attorneys William Burke and Robert Herr, the latter of whom was the special counsel who investigated Joe Biden's handling of classified documents and called attention to his age and mental dexterity in his report, noted that Trump was threatening federal funding critical to vital research and innovation that has saved and improved lives and allowed Harvard to play a central role in making our country's scientific, medical, and other research communities the standard bearers for the world. The Harvard showdown underscores just how critical it is that institutions inside and outside the government show resolve in the face of Trump's threats. It might come at a price, as Obama acknowledged at Hamilton College earlier this month, but it's not as if Columbia caving to this administration will be spared Trump's intimidation campaign. As always, the appeased bully has only sought further satisfaction, with the administration, still yet to restore the school's funding, now reportedly seeking to ensure the university adheres to its demands by putting it in a consent decree. It won't be easy for Harvard and any other universities that follow its lead, but to capitulate to this administration's authoritarian tactics is to help legitimize them. This is a time for institutions to muster strength. Next up, Elon Musk's breeding spree is so much wilder than you thought. The billionaire bureaucrat, who wants a legion level of offspring, has reportedly solicited women on X to have his children and pay his kids' mothers millions to keep quiet. This is by Issy Lipowski on April 16th. Elon Musk has solicited women to have his babies on X, shelled out millions of dollars to keep the mothers of his many kids quiet, and talked privately about wanting to sire legion-level numbers of children before the apocalypse. That's according to an extensive new report from the Wall Street Journal, which details how the baby-making billionaire keeps his brood of at least 14 children and the women who birthed them in check. It's a rare peek behind the curtain of what one woman Musk reportedly propositioned, described as Musk's harem drama. It's also a revealing look inside the paranoid mind of one of the world's most powerful people, whose obsession with dwindling birth rates has contributed to his apparent belief that civilization is on the brink of collapse, necessitating a backup plan on Mars. The report leans heavily on the story of Ashley St. Clair, the conservative influencer who went public in February about having Musk's child. As recently as last month, Musk said he wasn't sure if the child is mine or not, but the journal's report is loaded with receipts, including text messages between Musk and St. Clair, illustrating their relationship, as well as a paternity test result from last week showing there is a 99.9999% chance that Musk is the father. In one text viewed by the journal, Musk suggested during St. Clair's pregnancy that they move faster with their baby making. To reach legion level before the apocalypse, Musk's message reportedly read, we will need to use surrogates. In another, sent months after St. Clair delivered the baby, Musk reportedly replied to a selfie of St. Clair writing, I want to knock you up again. St. Clair said she was offered $15 million and a monthly stipend of $100,000 until the baby was 21, in exchange for agreeing to keep Musk's relationship to the baby and to St. Clair secret. In a text message reported by the Journal, Musk wrote that privacy was necessary because he is number two after Trump for assassination and that only the paranoid survive. After St. Clair declined to sign and later went public with her story, the Journal reports that Musk withdrew the $15 million offer and recently dropped payments to St. Clair down to $20,000 a month. According to St. Clair's lawyers, her legal fees in her fight against Musk have already surpassed $240,000. St. Clair is not the only woman that Musk reportedly punished for perceived indiscretion. According to the Journal, Musk also offered to impregnate crypto influencer Tiffany Fong after following her on X, but without ever meeting her in person. The online attention from Musk reportedly boosted Fong's following, enabling her to make $21,000 in a two-week period from X's creator program. But after Fong opted not to take Musk up on the offer and confided in friends about it, Musk unfollowed Fong, prompting both her income and engagement on X to decline, the Journal reported. The Journal story brims with other bizarre details about what makes Musk tick, like when he was campaigning in Pennsylvania for Trump and reportedly texted St. Clair that there has never been a competitive army composed of women. Another time, Musk reportedly texted St. Clair about a Japanese official asking him to donate sperm to an unnamed woman. "No romance or anything, just sperm," the text read. According to St. Clair, Musk followed through with the transaction, suggesting the number of kids Musk has actually fathered is even higher than what's known. The Journal's reporting also illustrates the role that top Musk aides, including the managing editor of Musk's family office, Jared Birchall, allegedly play in orchestrating Musk's dealings with the mothers of his children. In one exchange with St. Clair, Birchall reportedly pressured her not to seek out legal counsel. That always, always leads to a worse outcome for that woman than what it would have been otherwise, the Journal quotes Birchall as saying. In a post on X Wednesday, Musk did not comment directly on the Journal's allegations, but wrote simply, "TMZ is better than WSJ." And finally, RFK Jr.'s autism quackery is harrowing. This is by Izzy Lepowski on April 17th. April is Autism Acceptance Month, so how is our nation's top health official marking the occasion? By setting the movement for autism acceptance back by, just several decades. On Wednesday, Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. held a news conference about a new report by the Centers for Disease Control, which showed a continued rise in childhood autism diagnoses in the United States in 2022. The researchers behind the report found that growth is due in large part to increased screening for and greater identification of previously underidentified groups. But rather than co-signing those findings, Kennedy undermined them entirely. Casting autism as an epidemic, he dismissed the notion that increased diagnosis plays a role in these trends as a myth of epidemic denial. Kennedy called research into autism's genetic origins a dead end and instead vowed to get to the bottom of its alleged environmental cause by, you heard it here, folks, September. To back up his point, which scientists involved in the CDC's report immediately refuted, Kennedy pointed to only the latest cutting-edge research of the 1960s. In one study conducted between 1959 and 1965, Kennedy said scientists found rates of autism as low as 4.7 in every 10,000 kids. As of 2022, the CDC's new report showed the rate of autism in kids under 8 was 1 in 31. Autism condition characterized by profound impairments in social communication and behavior would have stood out like a neon sign, Kennedy said, as if pointing to a smoking gun. But the point Kennedy is so obviously eliding is that in the 1960s, autism was characterized by profound impairments, and now it's, not, hence the CDC's findings. The definition of autism has changed several times over since the 1980s and now includes kids with Asperger's syndrome, a social disorder that Elon Musk himself has said he was diagnosed with, and ADHD. The more you look for it, the more you find it, Dr. Maureen Durkin, one of the authors of the CDC report, told the New York Times. There are also other known factors that contribute to rising autism rates, like the fact that people are having kids later in life. Beyond his ideas about the origins of autism, Kennedy also appears to hold a dangerously archaic view of autistic people themselves. On Wednesday, he said autism destroys children, who he argued would grow up to never pay taxes, never hold a job, never play baseball, never write a poem, never go out on a date. Tell that to Daryl Hannah. In one particularly harrowing moment, he described autistic kids as a stain on the country's ballooning healthcare costs. This, of course, was always where Kennedy's journey as HHS secretary was going to lead. But as one of his fellow anti-vaccine crusaders told Stat News, he's the same Bobby Kennedy, just now with a lot more power. This brings us to the end of our time here at the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for listening, and come back next week for another full hour of VanityFair.com. Have a great week, everybody.